In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokin, Mira Salganik, and Ekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, and fair.
And this time, our program shall focus on issues somehow or other related to media, its role and its influence in the small world we're all living in, to use the Red Line trademark wording.
But how about the Red Line's trademark diversity, Katya?
Oh, don't worry, Sergei, it's still there. It's always there.
Well, I was just kidding, Katya, but go on, tell us.
Okay, so if you insist, sir. Well, we start with the loudest scandal of the week, or rather of the month, which is what we call Murdoch's case, or rather the news of the world scandal, if you prefer. A powerful revelation bringing up dozens of different problems, starting with an issue of standards in our trade, to what might eventually happen to the hugest media empire, leave alone what might now seem Rupert Murdoch's limitless influence in modern global politics, which in its turn brings us to another issue, this time an issue of freedom of modern mass media at large. We shall then move on to a role the world media has not played. I mean, the role of a whistleblower in the face of the biggest humanitarian disaster of recent decades, which is famine in the Horn of Africa. The tragedy, which experts say was forecasted several months ago, really deserved way more attention than the world media had been paying it. And finally, switching on to a somewhat lighter mode, we'll look at tricks media can play. Early July, the world media was appalled at the absence of Mr. Jiang Zemin at important party celebrations. There were all kinds of speculations amounting to no less than life and death issues. As it turned out, the news was wrong, and Mr. Jiang Zemin is safe and sound. However, the splash of media anxiety has effectively reminded the international community of a role the Chinese elder and a former general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party has been playing in the Chinese politics.
A rich choice, Katya, really, and a global perspective, if I may say. We are moving from Europe and the United States to Africa and eventually to the Far East. This is almost a world tour.
Well, indeed, a world tour, a global tour, something to remind you of the travel, vacation, the sun, the sea, the things that we are missing here. Welcome back, Sergei.
Thank you, Mira. But look, talking of travel, let's set off then. Let's get started.
Fine, okay. So off we go to our first section, Beyond the Headlines. And tell you what, the News of the World scandal has really been soaring way beyond the headlines. Though the story with the tabloid was unraveling for a number of years, I'm sure no one expected it to evolve into a huge blast like this one.
That's true. It was rather difficult to imagine the story would result in the British Prime Minister David Cameron winding up his African tour to be questioned by the British Parliament.
Well, and it was even more difficult to imagine Rupert Murdoch issuing his apologies to British MPs. Do you know that in 2010, Forbes placed him in the 13th place in the world's most powerful people list? Mind you, it's the 13th.
The 13th?
The unlucky number.
I never thought of that.
It's a fact. Well, but look, let's get back to our issue. After all, what is going on with Rupert Murdoch now is what the democracy is all about, isn't it?
Yes, Mira, but I wonder if you know about it, ladies. He hired an exceptionally strong team of PR experts.
Oh, yes, Sergei. I believe he hired someone like Alex Bigg and James Lundy from Edelman, which is the world's biggest PR firm. And they also say that his team suggested he should sit down with and apologize to the parents of Millie Dowler, the murdered girl whose phone News of the World had hacked.
True. But he also hired Sard Verbiner in New York and the Glover Park Group in Washington, D.C.
Sergei, you seem to be driving at something. What is it?
Well, Mira, these people are to help him with public and government relations in the States. I guess that might imply that News Corporation management hugely concerned that the scandal could spread from the United Kingdom all the way across the Atlantic. This is the problem.
And it certainly shall. If not for political reasons, then for some business considerations. Look, really, I imagine there is certainly someone who would love to bite into the creamy pie, not to say custard pie, of Murdoch's assets there. Look, it's Fox News, the Dow Jones, which is the owner of the Wall Street Journal, just to name a few.
Well, I agree, and in fact, due to the scandal, he already lost a bid for the BSkyB in Britain. This is important.
Right. Now, many have started to wonder whether the scandal means that the end of this empire.
Well, media markets in Asia and the Middle East still seem to offer him lush opportunities for growth. But look, we're just following the common logic and moving in the wrong direction now.
What do you mean, Katya?
I'm pretty sure that there are numerous aspects to the scandal. Yet some are more important and some are less important. And I'm not sure that the future of Murdoch's business empire is coming first on the agenda right now.
So, you propose that we discuss the political side of it?
Well, Mira, I get an impression that even in a story like this, politicians are once again trying to, how shall I put it, to capitalize on dramatic developments, but they don't seem to move to address the ultimate cause of it.
Oh, Katya, but there you are again with your usual skepticism.
But, Mira, just let me explain what I mean. Everyone seems to be coming down on David Cameron, for example. So, at the recent hearings in the UK Parliament this Wednesday, Mr. Miliband said Cameron had to make a full apology for hiring Andy Carlson as his director of communications, right?
Well, that's important, Katya. Carlson used to be the editor of the News of the World, who, just to quote the media, oversaw a flourishing criminal conspiracy.
Well, it's a murky business, you know. Cameron says that he was never been aware of that, but I can hardly believe it. Anyway, Carlson resigned in January this year.
So this is the situation with the British Prime Minister, and then there is some more for you. Look, now politicians in Great Britain are discussing whether the government should introduce more stringent rules regulating the media. And that, to me, is a double-edged sword, like you say.
And to me, that's a sheer absurdity. This is simply foolish. After all, weren't it the journalists, isn't it the press, who have been dugging this scandal in the first place and they have unveiled it?
Yes, Mira, yes, and those were The Guardian and its editor Ellen Rusbridger in the first place. And tragically enough, it was also Sean Hoare, a former reporter for the News of the World, who was found dead in his London apartment earlier this week.
Kind of.
Yes, and he was the first person to speak out about phone hacking. Do you remember?
And the bullying.
And the bullying, yes, at the News of the World.
And he was also the first person to talk on record about Andy Coulson's alleged awareness of the phone hacking by the News of the World. But look, I suggest we might make a break, and now we are joined by Kristen Patterson, a longtime columnist of The Independent, the UK.
I think it's a fantastically complex issue, and I think that in one sense what it comes down to is the decline of journalism and ownership of the media. And, you know, very, very rich people are not always particularly nice, but the newspapers won't survive without very, very rich people unless somebody comes up with an alternative funding model. So, you know, I think clearly there have been very big and specific problems associated with the Murdoch empire. But to be honest, I think it's extremely unlikely that phone hacking was limited to the News of the World. I wouldn't want to make any firm declarations about where else it might have been, but tabloid culture in this country has relied on that kind of sort of intrusive investigation into people's lives, which certainly is unpleasant, but you could argue it's the price you pay. I'm not saying the illegal stuff, but the intrusion. You could say that that's the price you pay for a free media, which, you know, which has resulted in the British press being, I think, one of the very best in the world.
Well, anyway, it is the British press which started the revelations.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, if investigative journalism was what uncovered this story, and the police failed to, the politicians were too frightened to, so absolutely, it's a free press that has enabled this to happen, and I would say that that's a bit more in jeopardy after the events of the past fortnight.
Do you think that this scandal might perhaps change the situation, or everything would just remain as is?
I mean, who knows? Who can say? I mean, who can say anything about the sincerity of the people involved? It's impossible to know, particularly when they've been so coached by PR people. But I would say that it's very unlikely that News International journalists are going to be involved in phone hacking in the immediate future, because whatever reign of terror there was that encouraged people to hack people's phones will continue, and that reign of terror will now go in the opposite direction. again. Oh. So I'm sure it won't continue there. And I think, you know, probably there will be, you know, everyone will be going on and on about ethics, and, you know, maybe there will be some sort of noticeable result in newspapers. But I think there might well be bigger results that won't be nearly as desirable. But I think, you know, the bigger issue, I think there will be a short-term, maybe long-term issue about respect for journalists, although, frankly, journalists have never been particularly highly respected by the public. But the much bigger issue is who is going to pay for journalism, because people don't want to pay for it anymore. You know, they want it all online. And I have to say again that, you know, Rupert Murdoch, to his credit, at least tried to tackle that issue with the paywall for the Times. And, you know, he's one of the only ones who's sort of made some kind of success of that. Everyone else expects to get this stuff for free. And, of course, when you get stuff for free, you know, you don't buy the paper. So, essentially, all newspapers are in major decline. And if no one's going to pay for any of it, then there aren't going to be any professional journalists, and there aren't going to be any undercover operations like this.
On the other hand, it's perhaps the money that has been driving those people from the News of the World to seek information at any cost.
I don't think it's the money. I think it's their jobs. I think when you've got an editor, I mean, a newspaper is, you know, quite a scary place to work. You know, the editor can be a bit like an emperor. And, you know, if the editor is saying, you know, telling you you've got to fill your pages, and, you know, and what they want is the kind of story that nobody else has unearthed, I can absolutely see why people would be driven to use methods that most people wouldn't consider to be hugely acceptable. You know, the editors didn't want to know what methods were being used. All they wanted was the results. And I don't think that was particularly a financial motive. I mean, it was a financial motive in that they wanted to be paid at the end of the month. But essentially what they wanted was to keep their jobs.
And by the way, do you know that the ripples from the scandal have already reached Mr. Murdoch's own country, Australia? On Thursday, the government said it is looking at strengthening privacy laws because of public concern over media intrusion in the wake of the News of the World scandal. And Australian Home Affairs Minister Brendan O'Connor wrote a piece for the Australian newspaper saying, and just let me quote from it, "The News of the World phone hacking drama is making people across the world sit up and think about their own media landscape, what's acceptable and what's not. And I think this is one of the key issues of the whole scandal."
Katya, I can very well understand his concern. Let me tell you, News Limited, the Australian division of the News Corporation, controls 70% of Australia's newspaper readership market. That's a
70%.
Lot. That's a lot, yes. And there's more. This week, Communications Minister Stephen Conroy accused Murdoch's company of campaigning for what he called regime change.
Oh, yeah,
so this is
really
pretty serious.
Thank you, Sergey.
Strong-worded.
Well, and it's a strong accusation, by the way.
Indeed.
But that effectively brings us to what I think is the key issue to the scandal. With a media empire intertwining so closely with power circles, doesn't it contradict the principles of the freedom of the press? That's my question.
Wait, Katya, not so fast. First of all, let me say that Murdoch's case is really a unique one. Let's agree on that. He's extremely tough. He's known for it.
Well, Sergey, but everyone thought that Murdoch would, in this situation, he would just walk out, too. He would resign or things. Don't forget, he's 80.
No, Mira, not him. He's a fighter. By the way, on Tuesday, they asked him if he was going to resign over the scandal.
What did he say?
He said, no, obviously, this is what I expected from him. He also said, just let me quote, "I feel that people I trusted, I am not saying who, I don't know on what level, have let me down, and I think they behaved disgracefully, betrayed the company and me, and it's for them to pay. I'm the best person to clean this up," end quote.
Well, he's tough, but to me he's
extremely
also
extremely tough.
Yeah, he is tough. But to me, he's also a symbol of a very specific culture, of a specific approach that focuses on selling information like any other kind of merchandise.
That's right. This is very important.
That's important. And so his principle is let market make its choice, right? Anything could be published if the demand is there.
You can produce any kind of sausages if the demand is there.
That's right. But if we talk of sausages, it's one thing. But to me, if we talk about the information, it's entirely different.
Yeah, it's something to think about.
Just imagine those tabloids. They're rather playing on people's not-so-noble desire to peep into the lives of others, into the private lives. So if the demand is there, why not publish the tabloids? But to me, it's immoral.
Well, if I may say so, I know that I might sound pompous, but never mind. I think that the trouble with the media and Rupert Murdoch's empire is a very good example of what I'm going to say, is that they are selling, imposing on many, on millions of minds, philosophy of consumption.
Oh, yes, Mira. I subscribe to it 100%.
Way of living based on consumption and consumption alone.
So isn't it a tragic twist in the philosophy of the humankind? I mean, we all know that there is something more to our lives than just consuming.
Now, let me ask you, if I'm a reader of Mr. Murdoch's papers, I mean, there are messes like them. Murdoch is not alone. Would I ever believe that there is anything else to life than being happy? And being happy means enjoying myself.
True.
And new generations are being brought up on it and nothing else.
Mira, may I really say thank you to you. Special thanks for a profound and sinister analysis of the situation.
But you know, Katya, let me also just put a word. So you said that information is a commodity. I think both yes and no. I'm 30 years in the profession, and I think definitely information is more than a commodity. It's not just a car or a house or real estate.
This is a powerful instrument,
and this whole story reveals that information is not just a commodity only, you see?
That's right.
So you may change government, you may just influence public opinion.
That's what I mean, Sergei. You may create
political crisis.
I don't agree with you. This is not an instrument. It's a weapon.
It's a weapon.
Weapon can be
a very strong weapon.
So we are just speaking about definitions, so weapons or instruments or
Sergei,
whatever.
But tell me about your emotions. Have you noticed for a recent trend that the information now is being treated more like a merchandise? We're talking about the newspaper markets. Okay, I don't mind that.
With your 30 years of experience.
This is very personal, and I was looking at this scandal in a different way. For a large part of the world, British media served as an icon. And believe me, in 1993, I remember how I was just undergoing some lectures in the British School of Practical Journalism in Cardiff in UK under Thomson Foundation. And I remember my lecturer, Mike Pearson, who was telling that this is extremely sensitive way just how to
handle information,
yes, and what to do if the journalist, for example, is getting in information which he has to reveal due to his professional ethics on one hand. On the other hand, he should be fully aware that this information can seriously jeopardize, well, certain political interests. Or we were speaking actually about Queen and the royal family, yes.
Which was also hacked, by the way, by the News of the World.
And look, 15 years after, still there is no answer to those questions.
No.
It depends. So all in all, I think what this scandal revealed, that we should not just say that British media is an icon and say Russian media is bad. So everywhere there's good media and bad media. There are good journalists and bad journalists. This is handmade product, you see. Sergei,
may I interrupt you? Now I want to stand up for the British media. Because to me, the British media was the media which unveiled the scandal. And Mr. Murdoch, with all his empire, to me, is a symbol of globalism. So it's to me, this story is globalism versus national media. And to me, the British media in this situation was just a token of the journalism standards. But getting back to our story, look, I've got another question. If there's a demand to be satisfied, a demand which comes from the public, from readership, but there could also be different demand. If we talk of readers, we can also talk of the demand from political elite. Doesn't it contradict the principles of the freedom of the press? We discuss this issue with our next guest speaker, Giulietta Chiesa, Italian journalist and politician.
Well, I repeat that the crisis is not a murder crisis. It's an explanation, it's a manifestation of a general crisis. Certainly, one of the biggest, maybe the biggest mogul of the world from this point of view, but it is normally, from this point of view, some kind of rule of law of the situation. It should have happened in a big giant. And this means, very simple, that from the economic point of view, the information became a merchandise. And if the information is a merchandise, you can produce a very expensive, useful, and false information, and you will produce for millions of people a very bad, false, manipulating information. This has been and it is now almost the overall line, not only of the tabloid. The tabloid is the worst of this example, but it is not of the tabloid the question. The question is of all the newspapers. Even the most significant newspaper have created the same situation. Look at the New York Times. Last year we knew that many journalists of the New York Times were paid to write things very useful for the Pentagon. We knew, very happy situation, that the Pentagon has a program to produce false information, and this information has gone everywhere in the world, everywhere. All the information around the Iraqi war was created in this way, and all the world, that means 3-4 billion people, have been manipulated for a long time, and they are now manipulated. What I mean is that in this situation, the independence of information from the market of goods and from the other side, the independence of the information from the political leadership of every country is reducing itself almost daily. That means there is a connection, very straight connection, between the power and the mainstream media. All the two are serving each other for what? Against the people. For what? Exactly against us. That they are working to hide the most important information, first. Second, to create a false skirmish of information to make the public discuss of stupid things, unnecessary things, secondary things. Third, they are telling the story of the power and not the story of the people. This is the consequence, and this consequence I would like to suggest, to underline. It means very simply the end of democracy. Because a single man in the street, in Italy, in Germany, in England, in the United States, and so on, has no instrument to verify what they are telling. Okay, somebody says, we have an alternative now. The alternative is internet, is web, but it is also an illusion to a big extent, because internet has been occupied by the so-called social network. And the social network, all network also, has already been used for that reason. The social network and the engines used by Google, by Facebook, by Yahoo, by YouTube, are already occupied by the power. They are deciding what direction to do. And recently I have read a very interesting book, How to Subvert the Regime, which has been written by an American professor, and where he explains very plainly that all the power in the West, I mean, maybe also in the East, I don't know to what extent, is already engaged in diverting the attention of the people, in producing expectation, in forming expectation and ideas, and all this is possible to call only in one way, is a mass manipulation. That means the answer is, well, Mr. Cameron can propose to change some rules. The question is that we have to change the rules of this information, and we have to change the system. And changing the system requires, for instance, something of this kind. I try to scandalize you. We have to eliminate from the information system all the advertising. The only way to reproduce a more or less normal situation is to avoid publicity and advertising from all the television channels. First step. That means you will ask, how we can do information without advertising? I say, my answer is very clear. Well, we need some kind of public investment in this direction. Information is a common good. Is an essential instrument of democracy. For that reason, states are obliged to give to the people the possibility to accede to good information. That means you have to have a program of financing in a large scale, private and public broadcasting structures under democratic control, without advertising. without having to take into account the will of the big oil companies or of the big producing merchandising companies. This is one of the way to go. I imagine that it is very difficult, it is very complicated, it requires a very high degree of political will, but without that, look, I don't believe to any new rule in this situation. This situation is completely already degenerating in such a kind of authoritarian system of control of the population.
By the way, colleagues, just remember Iraq. I recently read that not a single of Murdoch's 130 media outlets has opposed the war in Iraq. It was supporting the false dossier on the weapons of mass destruction. Anthony Barnett, who is the founder of Open Democracy, which is an international internet project, wrote, and just let me quote, "Had his media been genuinely investigative, as is now claimed for News of the World, they'd have exposed the lies and disinformation in the lead-up to Iraq. Instead, at Fox News especially, he helped create and disseminate them."
But Katja, that's the world we're living in. That's the time we're living in. That's the rule of the game.
Well, I'm not sure they're universal, those rules, you know. I strongly believe that the scandal has offered us some good lessons to reflect on. The rules of Murdoch's game failed him this time.
Oh, well, come on. I think you are too idealistic. If you ask me, the scandal will change nothing. Just mark my word, it won't change anything at all. Remember at the hearings, a protester tried to wield a plate of white foam right in Murdoch's face. Remember
it? Well, that's a standard situation, you know.
Yes. But what I was going to say is that the PR experts claimed it was good for Mr. Murdoch. The combination of Rupert Murdoch's age and the custard in his face or this attack, they said, have elicited a tremendous amount of sympathy. So here you are. So I'm asking you now, what kind of world are we living in?
I know you meant it to be rhetorical, but I think I'll answer, Mira. We're living in a suffering world. By the way, the scandal has made it rather difficult for David Cameron to defend his case for an increase of development aid for troubled countries. During his visit to South Africa and Nigeria this week, he discussed the issue as well as the aid to the suffering countries in the Horn of Africa, which are struggling to survive in a humanitarian catastrophe that broke out due to the drought, the worst in decades.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
But that brings us to our next section, Between the Lines, in which we usually talk about a most notable and provocative publication of the week. And this time, it's an opinion piece from Paddy Ashdown, the UNICEF UK president. So his piece was published by The Guardian this Thursday under a title, "Somalia's Children's Famine Has Been Ignored." This famine hasn't happened overnight, the paper goes, but it has been reduced to a footnote in the media's eyes by more sensational events. So how do you like it?
Well, I'm not sure I get the point, actually, Katya. Is Mr. Ashdown blaming the media for the crisis or what?
Well, Sergei, before we start discussing the piece, just let me quote from it. "In today's newspapers, from front to back," Mr. Ashdown wrote, "I was hoping to see the media use their power and influence to tell this story. I hoped to see headlines shouting that millions of women and children in Somalia and across the entire Horn of Africa are struggling for survival and need the British public to help. But I didn't. Instead, my eyes were blurred with articles of shaving foam and hacking scandals, as talk about the dire need for nutritional supplies for children who need their lives saved slipped into the footnotes. This famine didn't happen suddenly. It has been slowly evolving, but underreported." And Mr. Ashdown concludes the piece with another quote. "The media," he says, "also have a major role in the response to disasters. As former BBC producer Suzanne Franks pointedly wrote in the British Journalism Review, disasters, natural or man-made, exist only when they're covered by the media."
I agree. In general, precisely what we've been talking about right now, and of course, looking at children The footage that is coming from Somalia, I mean, it's impossible.
Yes, Mira. Children are the first ones to suffer from famine. They are less protected than the adults, and it's true that the media was not focusing on it for quite a while. Let us accept that. But now, I'm just back from my trip to Europe. There's a lot of headlines accusing the world community of moving too slowly to counter the crisis.
Well, quite so, Sergei. And when I've been speaking to experts, both in Africa and Europe, they were all telling me that the degree of awareness is extremely low. And besides, there's what they're calling the donor fatigue. It's something we've been discussing in our previous program. With budget spending cuts and a prospect of new bailouts and new defaults looming, national governments are reluctant to offer help.
Well, it doesn't make sense at all, even from a purely pragmatic point of view. No one is going to gain from a worsening situation out there.
You know, Mira, people are reluctant to give money because they are not sure that the money would go to help the hungry, really.
You have a point.
Yeah. And there's also the Al-Shabaab extremists operating mainly in the south of the country, worst hit by the drought.
Well, Al-Shabaab used to block international aid agencies, that's true, from entering the country. But now it itself has issued a plea for help. Look, the UN announced Somalia being hit by famine. Do you know what that means?
You tell us.
Okay. So according to the UN standards, famine implies that at least 20% of households, that's one-fifth, face extreme food shortages, that there's acute malnutrition in over 30% of people. 1/3 of people, acute malnutrition. There's water consumption, which is reduced to less than 4 liters a day. All in all, I mean, washing, drinking. And finally, the intake of calories is reduced to less than 1,500 a day, which is compared with the recommended 2,100 a day.
Truly, it sounds like mathematics of horror.
That's frightening. And there's another frightening development, Mira. As we all can imagine, people are trying to escape.
Refugees.
That's right. So, Somalis are seeking refuge in neighboring Ethiopia and Kenya. So, look, in Kenya, they are placed in overcrowded camps, which are now holding some 380,000 people. And this is more than 4 times the projected capacity already, and new people are pouring in. And on Tuesday, the UN Refugee Agency said that in June, death rates among Somali refugees arriving in Ethiopia were 15 times more than the baseline rate in sub-Saharan Africa.
Katya, and there's also a security issue, don't forget about that. Just who do you think would venture to go to a country which, for the last 2 decades, has been torn apart by a full-scale civil war? No, I think.
Well, but Sergei, living it as it is also impossible. The world cannot just stand by and watch people dying, right? Besides, if no one comes to their rescue, the instability is going to spread. Just listen to what Gabriel Nigatu, Regional Director for East Africa at the African Development Bank, told me about the crisis perspective.
Well, Katya, before you ask him, I would like to say one thing. Of course, one cannot wait and, you know, sort of look indifferently at what's going on. But let's be fair. The last famine, if I remember rightly, was in 1991-92. And humanitarian aid was flown there. And then government decided to shoot down a couple of American choppers. Remember?
And that's what I was saying. The Al-Shabaab prevented the aid agencies from coming.
No, I'm talking about what is going on now. I think that a number of agencies involved in supplying the humanitarian aid are afraid that it would finally get into the hands of Al-Shabaab.
You mean the aid?
Even the aid, that's what I mean.
Now we are joined by our expert, Ian Bray of Oxfam.
Mr. Bray, please tell me, how does your organization see the way the international community is reacting to the humanitarian crisis in Somalia?
Well, it's reacting very slowly and not very generously, with the exception of the UK government, which has been leading the charge as far as responding financially to this. Many of the other governments not responding as generously as they should do. There is now $800 million black hole in the aid response, and already the UN are saying that there is famine in certain parts of Somalia. There is certainly a terrible humanitarian crisis throughout the region, in southern Ethiopia, in northern Kenya, and in central south Somalia, because of a horrendous drought. Now, these droughts do not happen overnight, and the international community has been getting early warning systems that a drought was coming as early as January this year, and it does need to respond to these emergencies before they become a catastrophe. We are now in the 11th hour. We can save lives, but at the moment there is a drought, and there, in parts of Somalia, there is a famine. So we can act quickly, but the international community really has to be much more generous. The British public have been extremely generous. They have been given at least £20 million to our appeal. These are all the British aid agencies coming together and calling for generous donations from the public, and the public have responded extremely generously. So has the British government. But the other governments in Europe, in the United States, in Canada, need to step up to the plate. They really do have to fund this huge aid effort that's required to save lives. 10 million people's lives, more than 10 million people's lives, at risk here.
And Mr. Bray, I also know that Oxfam says that perhaps the international aid system might benefit from some sort of a shake-up.
Yes, it does need a radical shake-up so that we put first and foremost the needs of people who are at risk. That is so important. That is the reasons why aid is given, and it should be on need and need alone. What we don't want to see is aid being driven by particular foreign policies or by security concerns. We should be responding to people's need. People are in extreme dire need in East Africa, and we should be responding on the basis of that, not on any other basis.
Well, Somalia is a mismanaged country. We all know that.
But since the humanitarian catastrophe is breaking out there, the international community should act, at least to prevent the situation from deteriorating.
That's right, Kaza. But one last thing that I want to say. This is a horrible example of combination of natural disaster and the made-man one.
Absolutely. I fully agree to that.
That's awful.
And by the way, that's also a point made by Gabriel Negatu, Regional Director for East Africa at the African Development Bank.
The scope is still unfolding. I think from January early this year, it was estimated that food insecure population was estimated to be around 2 million. It's now much more than that. And cost of food has risen an average of 270% over the past year, and the commodity prices have gone up. And between the lack of available food and the inability of people, the lack of purchasing power to buy food has aggravated, and I suspect when all is said and done, a much bigger number. I hate to even project what the number could be, but it ranges from 5 million to 10 million people could be affected. Right now, I know it's close to 3 million, but it could easily go up to 5 million and beyond, unless urgent action is taken to address both the short-term food crisis, the famine, and the medium long-term root causes of this problem. The long-term response needs to focus on stabilizing the economy to enable people to have livelihood that allows them to have some purchasing power. You see, the food shortages are common, but if people have the means, the purchasing power, to buy food, then food in other regions can be moved around. So the economy needs to stabilize. The peace, the conflict needs to be addressed.
So do I get it right that the present crisis actually is not constricted to Somalia alone, but it's a rather regional crisis? It is going to have regional implications if not treated.
You're absolutely right. The epicenter of the crisis is Somalia. Then you have people migrating to neighboring countries. So a large population crossing the border into Ethiopia and to refugee camps. Even a larger population crossing over into Kenya. The drought itself has affected from Uganda to Kenya to Somalia, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. But the famine Mm-hmm. You have to differentiate between the drought and the famine. The famine, however, is in Somalia proper. Again, because this country does not have the institution and the stability required to address it. But it is a regional problem. And unless it's corrected, unless action is taken, the spillover effect into the local, into the region, will be significant. For us at the African Development Bank, we have just approved an emergency assistance program for Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, and Djibouti, the four countries. We are providing emergency assistance fund through the WFP, World Food Program, for the purchase and distribution of food. But the crisis, if it is not contained, could very easily spread into southern Sudan, further into Uganda, because people are migrating, people are moving out in search of food and water. So addressing it, containing it within the immediate region of Somalia is important. If not, this could spread very easily into the entire region, with grave consequences.
You're tuned in to the Voice of Russia.
And now we're moving to Red Line's concluding heading, Facing the News. This week it is the face of Mr. Jiang Zemin, former president of China and general secretary of China's Communist Party. Jiang Zemin's name hit the world headlines as he was conspicuously absent at celebrations marking the 19th anniversary of the Communist Party of China on the 1st of July. So TV cameras in this minutely orchestrated event lingering on each face of elderly Chinese statesmen did not show one of the architects of modern China, whose name was linked to some of the most significant turns in the country's recent history.
Well, and let me add to that that Mr. Jiang Zemin, who is now 84, was the president of China from 1989 to 2003, and he took the helm of the world's largest economy. Yet, by the time he had handed the presidency over to Hu Jintao, China had become one of the world's most powerful economies. This blistering economic growth was, however, marked by a lack of correspondent political reforms.
Still, Jiang Zemin is widely credited with bringing political stability to the country and continuing Deng Xiaoping's reforms. And most importantly, his handover of power to President Hu Jintao was, by the way, seamless. And I believe that it is a first case in modern Chinese history. Is that correct?
Something like that.
Well, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Jiang Zemin's absence has prompted the tea leaf reading political analyst and the Beijing gossip mill to speculate that he must have been too sick to appear in public.
Oh, really?
However, yes. Mira, a week later, Hong Kong's Asia Television interrupted its main evening newscast to announce that Jiang had died. And the announcement virtually exploded world media. And later, ATV kept up the news for several hours on a ticket promising to air a special report on Jiang's life late in the evening.
Well, instead, the ATV had to run a one-paragraph statement of apology, just to quote it, to the audience, Jiang Zemin and his family, as the official Xinhua news agency came out with its own announcement. So Xinhua quoted, or which it denoted as authoritative sources, as saying, and just let me read it, recent reports of some overseas media organizations about Jiang Zemin's death from illness are pure rumors.
Katya, I think this is a textbook example that information is more than a commodity.
Well, I'm not sure.
One of the examples.
It could be some kind of precious commodity that is only traded way more expensively. But anyway, the wording sounded rather odd. Besides, it was reported that Xinhua's statement appeared only in English.
How do you like this, Sergei?
I could not confirm that. I can't read Chinese.
Same here. In the meantime, the Shandong News website in Northeast China posted a black banner with white characters on it saying, our respectable comrade Jiang Zemin is immortal. Well, the next morning, the website was not made available.
Meaning it was closed? It was shut down?
It was shut down.
Interesting.
I must say, Kate, that the Chinese bloggers were demonstrating a lot of ingenuity in their guerrilla warfare against the authorities' efforts to banish anything remotely resembling a search keyword for related to Jiang Zemin. Now, for instance, even the word river, because it appears that Zan, I think, means river in Chinese. So he's sort of Mr. Really? Mr. River.
Oh, strange. But as a matter of fact, it was the fault of the Chinese web censors who lent a lot of credence to the rumors by trying to scotch them. Because there's no doubt that were a dignitary of Mr. Zhang's statue dead, the government of China could not but announce his demise and give an appropriate state send-off to the former head of state and Communist Party. So,
sure. A more plausible version has recently appeared in Japanese Asahi Shimbun, which reported that Deng Zemin's brain is dead, but his body is being kept alive by, you know, one of those...
artificial respiration. Yeah.
Yes, and the report is echoing what was being passed around the China Watcher insiders and, you know, the circles, that even his family, I mean Deng Zemin's family, approved to pulling out the plug, but it needs to have the final approval of the inner echelon of Chinese party.
So what kind of speculation is that, really? It's pure speculation. I remember that we were told to handle the information with utmost care, that we were not supposed to run the news which is not confirmed. So what kind of this? And by the way, Asahi Shimbun is a respected paper, isn't it?
Yes, Katya, Asahi Shimbun is a highly respected paper. But Asahi Shimbun is a part of Japanese media. We're speaking about China and Chinese media and Chinese way of disseminating information. So in this respect, I think that China's secretiveness is notorious. But the Chinese authorities, as you understand, are particularly sensitive in matters of Chinese leaders' private life, especially their health problems. These are guarded like state secrets. No less, and the same thing is with North Korea.
Well, with all totalitarians.
Sergei, why should you be surprised of all people? Don't you remember that the Soviet leaders seemingly had no private lives at all and no health problems either? They lived in an inhabited and opaque world of their own. People like you and me and Katya and everybody knew just their faces, just their names and their speeches on special formal occasions. Nothing beyond it. And the poor people called at that time the Kremlinologists. What a hard time they had trying to squirrel out bits and pieces of rumor and gossip to build on it their highbrow analysis and prognostications.
And finally finding themselves the surprised heirs that advent of perestroika, right? That is another side of the medal, which is called the privacy, you know?
Well, that's a big question, Katya, the privacy. Now, we just spoke about the Chinese bloggers trying to bypass the censors. And the Chinese government didn't even make a squeak. It was so sure, so confident of its sovereign right.
Well, on the other hand, no government comments on the rumors.
Well, sometimes they do. And it's not really the confirmation or unconfirmation. After all, if the all elderly men did not appear at the public function, the government doesn't have to comment it at all.
That's right.
On the other hand, if you try to suppress the bloggers with such damn insistence...
That's what I was saying. That's a double-edged
situation.
Everybody
smells a rat.
That's right. So that's the peculiarity of modern information space to me.
Well, I believe that private life is a private life, but in a democratic society, in a democratic world...
There should be no private life.
People have legitimate right to know what's going on with their leaders. And I think this is an abnormal situation when just for weeks... people have to trade rumors or just to hunt for news on the web.
Sergei, but Mr. Deng Zemin is no longer an official leader of
but
the country.
But still, he is an icon. He is a symbol of the reforms.
No. He's more than that, Sergei. He's more than that. Because the retired politicians of his stature
in China are still with the influence.
I don't understand what is wrong, given just a statement about the state of his health. One should never forget that in China, many things are done in a traditional manner, which is seldom understood by observers outside China. And maybe my irritant remarks are just another example that sometimes we don't understand China and Chinese ways of doing things. So let us try to look at the political situation in China as it is today. Deng Xiaoping wielded power as paramount leader despite having given up all his posts except the honorary chairman of the Chinese Bridge Association.
Did you say Bridge Association? I never thought that China had one.
Well, never mind. Deng Zemin, more than a decade after he stepped down in favor of Hu, still retained enormous power within the party, government, and military, and was still consulted on many issues. So he was like a shadow leader, at least until recent weeks.
Well, there are speculations in the Western media that Jiang Zemin could even have a word in choosing president who's a successor. Even that, you remember that Hu has to step down in 2012.
Yeah, next year. I just want to quote Professor of Chinese Politics at the National University of Singapore, Zhen Yongyan, who really ought to know. Just look what he says. New leaders are selected by old leaders who become members of important selectorate. After he passes away, other current leaders will become more influential.
Well, selectorate, I like it. Selectorate is an apt term. Retired leaders are also thought to have a say in the selection of the next Politburo Standing Committee, which is the top decision-making body in China, which is due to see 7 of its 9 members retire next.
Which should mean a significant rehash at the top and a change in power balance.
And for all that, we know Mr. Jiang might have a say in shaping the new power balance. He might be too weak to appear in public, yet strong enough to exert his influence in state and party affairs.
Well, then it reminds me of one thing. When I was starting as journalist, my seniors used to tell me that a good journalist should always know where to obtain the information quickly. The emphasis was always, even at that time, quickly and accurately on whatever he has to know but doesn't know. Well, it seems that now we are living in the internet age and getting information is no problem at all. Just push to a couple of buttons and...
It depends on what kind of information you get in the internet.
That's what I wanted to say. It has... But the accuracy of this information is at a premium. And this premium is ever on the increase because it's more and more difficult to verify it, to be sure of it.
Well, true.
Well, now we're getting back to what we've been talking all the time along. The point is that the Chinese government, I agree with you, Sergei, fully, could have stopped the whole scandal or, the tea leaf reading by issuing a simple statement that we are very sorry for the rumors, but our dear comrade Jiang Zemin is alive and kicking. That's all. That would have pacified it. Instead, they tried to scorch the rumors spread by the bloggers. Okay. Versus the insatiable greed of mass media that wants to get the information, that wants to get it quickly, never mind the veracity.
Moreover, it wants to be the first to get the information.
That's it. And if there is no information, never invent it.
That's right. That's a never-ending race for information. That's market
it.
Rules.
That is.
But let us agree that this scandal involves China, which is so often criticized for suppression of freedom of expression.
But look, Sergei, if you look at the other side of the coin, it is also the indiscriminate handling of information, or just, how shall I put it, downright manipulation with it. So, doesn't it set you thinking? And with this, we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and myself, Yekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
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 Goodbye.
So long.